How can we engage the culture, especially in books, music, and movies, with charitable and critical discussion through a lens of faith and as a means of drawing ourselves and others closer to Jesus? I'm Ali LaVille.
And I'm Andy Norton. This is Though They Die, talking about the things of this world through the lens of eternity. Today we're discussing the tragedy of Macbeth. Welcome to the show.
Okay. Yeah. I got so nervous because in our notes it still has the intro from the last episode, which says The Mandalorian. Yes. And I was like, oh no, Andy, you can do it. You can do it, Andy. I think I would have messed it up because I see words and I read them.
I'm always assuming that my notes might be wrong. You know, that I just am.
What's the Spider-Man? what does MJ say? Never have
expectations. She says, exactly. She says, if you expect to be disappointed, then you'll never.
And if that isn't the Gen Z mentality.
Oh my gosh. It's so true.
To the show, yes, though, as welcome, we already welcome. Said. Yes. But in our animated note, in our, our, what was, what would we do the intro? It's like, welcome back to NPR. But that, now we have to like actually welcome you or something? I don't know.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely.
Anyway, welcome. Yes, We're talking about the tragedy of Macbeth.
Prepare to feel the feels. Tragedy of Macbeth. I'm so excited to talk about this. Especially because
thrilled out of my mind.
Yeah. So this was really exciting. Even just watching it was really fun. So to be clear too, I think we're talking mainly about the movie.
Yes.
That just dropped.
Yep.
The tragedy Coen of Macbeth.
Brothers, right?
Is the original?
Coen Brothers?
Yeah. Well, it's Joel Coen of the Coen Brothers. Yes, is the director.
Oh, yes.
Just him. Just the
wow,
one.
Saucy.
but no, this just came out. It's on Apple Plus.
Super fresh. Yep.
It's available. Oh, you can watch it in theaters still. Maybe if you're in January of 2022. But it's on Apple Plus. So if you have a subscription there, it's free to watch. As many times as you want to.
Boom.
So, yeah. But also, I'm assuming... So, is the original play called The Tragedy of Macbeth, or is it Macbeth?
That's a great question that my theater education did not...
you Google that, and while you say that, let me just say right now, let me apologize for all the times I'm going to say Macbeth, like I just did just a second ago. I'm so sorry. It's Macbeth, even though it's spelled
Macbeth. You just can't think about it. It's just Macbeth.
Macbeth.
There you go.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So it's the tragedy of Macbeth.
That is the original
play. That looks like
play.
And the original Beautiful. Folio, first folio.
And of course, though, half of the new like modernist takes on it are just Macbeth. Because of course.
Most times it's advertised, you would just see Macbeth right now, I think.
Right. Cool. Well, this is so exciting to talk about because I mean, of course, Ali, if you guys don't know, Ali has a strong theater background. Extensive.
Generous. That is also
strong.
Very generous of you.
Could be weak, but it's extensive for sure.
I went to theater school for 2 years.
Right.
I had done theater in high school and all of that stuff. So I am like, I have done professional work, but I am by no means an expert at all.
That's extensive to me,
but
for sure.
Well, okay. I mean, compared to like folks that go get a management degree or whatever, right? Like, yeah, it's extensive.
Totally.
But I also like, I don't claim any like authority necessarily.
Sure.
Because I was only in school long enough to do like a single Shakespeare class kind of thing and then outside work and that sort of stuff. So I've only been in like one Shakespeare production even. So I really don't.
Okay.
Listen to my opinions. I hope you gain something from them. But also if you're listening and you have a lot of experience, please know I by no means am trying to like claim
totally.
Major authority.
Totally.
Yeah.
But you definitely were familiar.
And I will say things wrong, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes. Yeah. But you had definitely read it, seen productions of it, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So interestingly, I had never read it and I had never
blows my mind,
never watched
dude,
a production.
Blows my
I did
mind.
Not know the story. I did not
that,
know the story.
That's what blew my mind even more. Not so much that you weren't forced to read it in high school or whatever, but that you had that no one had ever been like, oh yeah, it's this really classic story about this guy that sucks.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, well, you can tell that something bad happens. It's tragedy of Macbeth.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that Macbeth himself like does anything wrong, etc. Yeah, so this is really cool coming into it, just like, you know.
That's what a gift.
I know,
that you get to experience that as an adult. Because
cool.
I think Shakespeare is ruined for so many people as they're in high school or middle school because they're like, ugh, excuse me, like, gosh, I'm becoming what I hate. Because they are not in a place to receive it, whether it's because of angst from school or they don't have life experience enough to appreciate the depths of the human condition that I think Shakespeare actually reaches. And that makes me sound like some overeducated snob, I'm aware. But I genuinely think Shakespeare is for the common man.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, we really need to pay attention to what he's saying. And there's really good professors that make great arguments for Shakespeare being very Catholic and potentially being a closeted Catholic and some stuff like this that I'm not going to get into because I am not qualified at all. But I think there's a lot there that really can bridge gaps in our experience as humans that Shakespeare just speaks beautifully into. And so even if you don't understand the language, I just encourage you not to be intimidated by that, because there's so much that I genuinely think that the Lord has for you to learn from these texts.
Yes.
So I set totally aside agree. Your high school, middle school scarring.
Set it aside. Kill the past.
Yeah, amen.
Absolutely. That's so true. And the thing is, I would say too, here's my feeling. Hot take.
Come on. Let's go, Andy.
Okay. Shakespeare is, I think, owned in large part, my sense is, by English majors and people who are really into like reading and literature.
Sure.
But the thing is, they're plays.
Oh, right?
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I think the thing is, many people are like, here, you're assigned to read the tragedy of Macbeth. And I'm sure that many great teachers are like, you know, no, we're going to go watch a production of it. Or you need to watch this as it's a video of a production as well as read this. But I just think that sometimes we rip poems out of context or plays out of context and then pretend that a prose take on it is the same. The thing I'm really actually fed up is not Shakespeare, but is Beowulf, the ancient epic poem.
Yeah.
Everyone has to read these stupid prose versions of Beowulf when it was a poem. It was like Shakespeare. Imagine having to read a Shakespeare like prose story and being told that that's Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Like that's not.
It's not.
Like you need to either read the actual text or you really should be, I think, watching a production of it.
Yep.
But with Beowulf, like people would always read these prose translations from the Old English.
Mm-hmm.
But what you really need to do is, if you want to read Beowulf, if you were wounded at one point having to read a terrible translation of Beowulf, you need to go find the translation by Seamus Heaney or Haney, who was the...
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I will. He was the National Poet Laureate of Ireland. And
name like Seamus, he better be.
Right,
shoot.
He better Come be. On. Yeah. And he translated it in a way that was actually true to the poem. The form. And so I thought of him actually a lot too when this started, because the king is from Ireland and he sounds like Seamus Heaney. But so I will say though, too, before we get into like what this is about, I'd love to share the synopsis all that. But I want to quickly say what you just said, like, don't be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I came in not knowing the story, not having seen it, not having read it, and I loved it. And I really was able to easily get into it and understand it. And I think that even like some of the criticisms, I read a few like criticisms of this take on it. And part of what they criticize is that they aggressively maneuvered around like the historical pieces of it.
Mm.
So you weren't kind of distracted or confused by the kind of Scotland specific historical pieces of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And instead it feels like a very, just like, I get the story. Everything that I'm hearing is just, it's making sense. I don't need to understand the historical context to understand this play. So yeah, I think that anyone could appreciate this and get into it.
I think a note on some of what you were saying about taking Shakespeare out of context and Beowulf kind of thing is that, I mean, it, just to do a quick relation, obviously not as grave, but it's like when we take personal relationship with Jesus out of reading sacred scripture, or we try and look at it just as a history book kind of thing.
So true.
And as much as you wouldn't appreciate sacred scripture the way that you are intended to and the way that it's supposed to pierce your heart if you were just in a class flipping through it necessarily, it's not until you really take it in its proper place, which is in your heart with a personal relationship with Jesus, allowing him to speak through it, that you're really able to understand it. So I think similarly, if you look at Shakespeare and Beowulf, and then you see it in the context it was meant to, which was meant to be for the common man, right? Yeah. Shakespeare is very much like everybody would come to see Shakespeare. This was not an experience solely for the wealthy.
Yes.
Then you can come to understand that he was, yeah, appealing to the masses in many ways. And I think we have to recognize, like, in all humility, right, that that's us, yeah. That we're not necessarily the, you know, we are the common man, right? Yeah, and we have to claim that, and then recognize, like, in all humility, that we relate to these characters 100%. On some level, however small or large that may be. And what we'll get into too is, like, how I think we have to see ourselves in Macbeth, and maybe not necessarily to some of the lengths that he goes, of course, but we have to recognize our own brokenness and realize that we are broken and flawed, and we have to contend with that. And we see how he contends with that. So I'd love to,
gosh,
jump in.
I love that. What a great way to set that up. Thank you.
Come
Ellie.
On, you
That's
got
so
it.
Good. Let's That's go, so good. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go into the synopsis. This one's very
by Andy
straight
Norton.
Up. This by Andy Norton. No, Googled by Andy Norton.
Googled by Andy Norton. Even better.
This is going to tell you.
What is it? Dwayne Gretzky, Michael Scott. That's Google Andy Norton.
Okay, so this is going to tell you straight up what happens. So if avoid
spoilers,
this is all the spoilers.
Everyone.
So in fact, actually, stop right now. If you want to go watch this again, it's only an hour and 45 minutes.
It's pretty quick.
It's on
they
Apple
cut a lot.
Plus. It's really good. Yeah. Go watch it and then come back and listen to this podcast. Otherwise, just if you want to just engage in it with us, engage right now. So, three witches tell the Scottish general Macbeth that he'll be king of Scotland. Encouraged by his wife, Macbeth kills the king, becomes a new king, and kills more people out of paranoia. Civil war erupts to overthrow Macbeth, resulting in more death.
There's a lot of death in this.
A lot of death, yeah, for sure.
So much
death. So yeah, that's a pretty fair, straight up synopsis that does not hit
to the
themes
point.
At all, other than
it's very does. Objective. Just
yes.
These are the things that happen.
Yes, exactly. Now, that being said, let's just jump right in. Like, what's the first, like, theme that maybe strikes you with this? Like, what do you think one of the themes? There's definitely a lot of themes in this.
I think pretty right off the bat is trust. Duncan, who is the king of Scotland, is just a very benevolent and righteous man. We come to see very immediately. There's a big battle that happens, and some traitors are discovered in the battle, and one of them is dispatched. But before he's killed, the traitor confesses his treason and, you know, apologizes and recognizes the goodness of the king and how good he was to him,
right?
And all this stuff. And one of the guys is communicating this to the king, and the king is like, "Wow, yeah, that's good for him, you know, like living his last moments well." And someone else pipes up and is like, "Ah, but he was a traitor and he stanked and all this stuff." And the king's like, "No. He did it right. He went out right," kind of thing. Yeah. So we instantly see that the king is just merciful, right? And I'm not so I've, you know, to clarify, of course, like, I'm not by any means condoning, you know, death conversion kind of thing as a means of, like, practical method. But we have to recognize the time period, right, and how common this was and that sort of thing, and recognizing the king's benevolence in that circumstance where he could have easily, right, just disregarded this guy who's now dead and whose land he has to pass on. So he passes on the land to Macbeth, and this is the first kind of cue in when these three witches are prophesying to Macbeth. They hail him by a new title of land, which he previously did not possess, and he has no idea that he's about to. He's like, "I'm sorry, why do you, that guy lives in his well. Why are you calling me
Thane of Cawdor?
Yeah. And then they say, "And to be king thereafter." And that's when he's like, excuse me? And so it's these seeds that these witches are planting. And I love. Who played the witch? I can't even remember.
I forget her name.
She did a fabulous job.
And so in fact, I'll just cut in and say too, if you're watching the movie, there's a very, very creepy scene very early on when you first see the witch, the first witch. Super creepy. It's kind of disturbing the way she's, like, moving her arms.
She's doing some contortion work. Yeah.
Well, actually, I rewatched the very beginning of it, and did you notice she actually is flapping her arm at one point and doing, like, this kind of weird walk?
Yeah.
She's trying to look like one of the ravens or the crows, is what she is. Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's really brilliant.
I love that.
It's super awesome.
Really,
because at one point, or throughout the movie, it's, like, going back and forth between representing the witches as these actually figures, or as like ravens or crows. Yeah. The same thing. I don't know.
ravens are bigger? Crows?
I think you're right.
I think crows are smaller.
Right, yeah. Right. Do they call them ravens in this or crow? I forget what it is.
Do they even ever reference the bird? I think they just kind of
they say, the raven himself is hoarse that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan. That's, I'm pulling up a quote. Oh. Yeah, so they do say raven at one point. At least it's not clearly referencing the
right, but they probably pulled on
That's what they pulled on, yeah, exactly. So it's creepy, but the thing is, there's a couple other points in the movie where, like, they pull, like, a toe out of their mouth and other, like, gross stuff.
Yeah.
Like, very small, quick things. By and large, it's not a horrific or... I thought it was going to be like a horror on some level, and
yeah, it's filmed it's as not. Such. Yeah.
It's not. It's not. It's more really like, not.
It's a thriller in many ways, I think.
Yeah. So keep going. Yeah. If you gotten to that point, keep going. It's not going to be
definitely
weird.
Not for kiddos or anything, but I would hope you would recognize that just from the synopsis.
Absolutely. Anyway. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's so great. I think trust is huge right in the beginning, and that's because Macbeth is already conspiring at the end of the first act there, like to kill Duncan. He goes away and he tells the stars to dim their lights so that they don't see his evil thoughts, and because it hurts him already, because he recognizes that Duncan is good. Like, he's not, it's not as though he's been, you know, riding his back his whole life and never, you know, gives him more grants and doesn't trust him in battle or anything. Like, no, the king is merciful, benevolent, and generous.
Yes.
Might be a little redundant there, but you get the idea. And here's Macbeth, like, thinking about killing this good man, right? This innocent man.
Yeah.
And so immediately he's in contention with that. And his wife, of course, is pretty resolved at the get-go, which is interesting how that kind of flips over the course of it. But trust, I think, is huge at the beginning.
Yeah.
Because the king is just, boom, giving him all his trust.
It's so true. The king is almost an image of like, the father in terms of, like, just giving this trust over and like allowing himself to be betrayed in a sense, because he does just trust,
ouch.
Right? He just, he's not on guard.
Yeah.
Doesn't that happen right in our lives where the Lord allows us to betray him? Like, he's not protecting himself from our wounding.
Yeah.
And so I was so struck by that. And of course, like I said before, as soon as Duncan, the king, starts talking, I was like, I know this voice. And it sounds exactly like Seamus Heaney of the Irish poet. And so, in fact, also, quick other note is that they say Thane of Cawdor.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that word Thane in any other context?
No.
Okay, yeah, I don't think so. So only other context I've heard it in is in Beowulf and in The Lord of the Rings, which, of course, was heavily influenced by Beowulf.
Right.
And it's a old English word that essentially means sort of like servant, and also like a landlord, like someone who has land inherited to them.
Yeah.
So it's another way of saying like lord, Thane. But immediately in my mind, I'll come back to this later. Immediately in my mind, I was hearing Thane. I was hearing the way he was talking. I was thinking of Beowulf. I was thinking of Lord of the Rings, like very quickly. And I wasn't expecting that for some reason. I think often when I think of Shakespeare, I'm thinking more like high court whimsy is like normally what I'm that's more of the Shakespeare I think I've seen.
Yes. 12th night,
yes. And this was more like, oh, this is actually kind of epic. This is epic. Mm-hmm. This is tapping into like some old English stuff here. And so I'm definitely going to return to that. Tolkien does not come out of this unscathed. We will talk of him. So yes.
Okay.
But yeah, so you said that was an awesome transition in the movie. You've gotten to know him. You're unsure of where he's at with the prophecy. He seems to almost disregard it and be like, yeah, whatever. Like, they said that. But then he's made Thane of Cawdor as the witches prophesied.
Yep.
And then the king does this sort of like, he bestows on his son. In the sight of everyone, he says, you know, Malcolm is is to be my heir, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Makes him the prince of something or other. And Macbeth wears a false face in the room, but quickly excuses himself and then quickly reveals to the audience that he's frustrated by this and is like, and sees it as a hurdle placed in his path that he needs to, or leap, as they say in the book, or leap. I love that phrase.
Get over it.
Yeah. And so coming then to the house, As he's returning and all this, you're starting to get you're getting introduced to Lady Macbeth, right? What did you think of her? Even just the way they set up her entrance, like what did you think of that?
It's very dramatic. Yeah. She's set up in it feels like the biggest space we've seen to that point, because we haven't really been in any structures outside of a tent up to this point.
Right.
So this is the first time we're introduced to a kind of a castle, and it is just imposing. Yeah. It's very imposing, and it's eerie, and it's sparse. There's not a lot of stuff. There's not like tables around or anything. No. It's just kind of room with massive archways. And I think that speaks a lot to how she is. Yeah, how she is. I mean, she's not, you know, notice she's not, she doesn't have advisors by her. She's not necessarily, you know, she's not taking this to prayer or anything. She's all very much just going for it from her own.
She's not
self.
Even in the midst of her own like work or labors, or like you never see her like taking care of the household or anything.
She's in her mind, just in her head. Plans. Yeah. Which is a really interesting take. I know there's another version. It's set in Soviet Russia.
Oh,
and
cool.
I can't remember who plays Macbeth. It's a big name. But I think she does do a little bit more work in that one. Like they have kind of a conference in the kitchen while the banquet is happening later and some of that sort of thing. So it is interesting that in this one, they very deliberately chose for her never to do much of any, like menial tasks or even like a letter writing or anything. I mean, there's one point where she hands a cup to him. She does bring the daggers.
Yes.
Right. That's a big movement she does, but most of her, she's very pensive. Yeah. Very pensive.
Yeah.
And calculating. So so her entrance is, you're not really set up to like her. You're pretty immediately like, oh my gosh, like this woman is scary resolved. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the scene lends itself to that, which is interesting because Macbeth is not resolved at this point.
No, he's not.
He's very much in conflict still.
And in fact, I mean, do you think it's intended to be sort of an Adam and Eve callback? Because that's definitely the vibe I got. Is that, you know, in a sense, she does play the temptress to him in a way that
she
like
totally does,
some people, you know, which I don't think is the only way to interpret the Adam and Eve story in scripture. But on some level, that's how it goes, right? That she says, take the apple, and he does. He takes and eats. But on some level, she, in the play, she has already made up her mind to do this thing.
Yeah.
And she is trying to draw her husband into the plan.
Right.
And he's definitely of at least two minds from like very straight on, very quickly. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's guiltless and she draws him in. It's more so that she's calling on his ambition and his greed and the darker parts of him.
Right. Right.
But it's a very broken marriage, right?
Yeah, because fruitless. Well, and I think a lot of it is built on like different things. I mean, they had a fruitless. She's a fruitless womb.
Yes.
If I can say that, and so as a result, I mean, this plays in later.
Yeah,
big moment. So he kind of, just to fast forward real quick, and then I'll backtrack. He of course kills the king and regrets it, and she's resolved. But then it flips shortly thereafter, and she is like, oh my gosh, what is going on? And he's like, we need to kill more people. And she's like,
oh, that's right. Yes.
And she sees he's going a little crazy, and she's trying to keep it together. And eventually she goes crazy and kills herself. But in one of these moments where he's kind of losing it, or she sees he's gone, he really hurts her. He really wounds her, talking about her barren womb.
Oh gosh.
And how, Banquo was guaranteed a line of kings, starting with Fleance, his son, and Macbeth cannot have that because he has no heirs, he has no children, and can't because Lady Macbeth, I don't know on whose fault it's owed, but they're infertile,
right?
And this is all the more interesting because what wounds her later is what fuels her in the beginning. So to backtrack now, before the king is dead, she is. She at one point systematically goes through what makes her a woman and asks for all of it to be undone so that she may encourage her husband to go about this act, which is so distinctly against, you know, human dignity.
Right.
And in order to do that, she has the famous line, "Unsex me here," and is talking about all of these womanly characteristics that she would rather not have in order that she could be the one that just kills him herself. But instead she knows that she must get rid of all of these womanly instincts and intuition and yada, yada, yada in order to convince her husband to. So what she uses, which is to be not what she is, which is a woman and, you know, created to, bear children, right? That's what the body was meant for. She rejects that. And then later, the lack of that, right, is what wounds her so deeply.
Yeah.
And she feels that she has rejected what she was made for. And that, I think, is really when she starts to spiral, because she's not living in the truth, right? Which is that she's a daughter of God, and in her state in life, right? She was made to bear children and this stuff. And because she's rejected that instead of accepting where she's at and all this stuff, really causes some just major woundedness in it. And she eventually takes her life because of it. So it's very interesting that in the beginning here, she is rejecting that.
Rejecting, yeah. Interesting that you say that. Like,
it's a lot of spiraling there. I hope that came across well.
No, I think you totally did. Okay. That's a great point, is that later on, it's his accusation of her womanhood or against her womanhood that that leads her to spiral into taking her life.
Yeah.
But it's earlier, it's her accusations of him and his manhood.
Yeah.
Because she's attacking his manhood and saying, like, were you a man, like, you would do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's those accusations that lead him into the act.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a clear reference to Adam and Eve right there.
Yeah,
is like that, just totally. the mutual accusations.
Totally.
Like, what a reflection of the brokenness of human relationships, of man and woman, and specifically of husband and wife. Yeah. Like the mutual accusations. I mean, beginning in the garden, right? The woman who you gave to me told me to eat, right?
Mm-hmm.
The serpent made me do it. Like these accusations are so brutal and cutting
fruit.
And bitter fruit, exactly. Yeah. And I think she just misunderstands completely what it means to be a woman or a man. Like the fact of, like, unsex me here, that I might not have, like, these emotions or this tendency toward nurturing and toward peace, and rather be a man and just be heartlessly killing the king.
Right.
That's not what a man is.
Right.
That's a total misunderstanding of what a man is.
Yeah.
And she leads him into that, into this distorted form of man.
Right. She's basing it all off of the assumption that the weaker sex implies that there is no strength in the sex.
Right.
Like this kind of that because of that all strength lies in the male sex kind of thing seems to be where her logic is coming from.
Yeah. It's a false take, but also, I mean, it's a take that I think comes from, can come from some people's experience of a broken world.
Totally.
Sure.
Totally.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and something I just wanted to clarify as well, I was just thinking about my words there. So obviously, right, like the female body, you know, is objectively created to bear children, right?
Yeah,
like that's what it's set up for, right?
Right.
So in so much as the male body is set up to aid in the process. That said, right, like, I don't mean to therefore say that there is no fulfillment outside of childbirth for a woman.
No.
And I just wanted to clarify that, right? Like, the Lord 100% fulfills that for each person in its own call, in their own state of life. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are religious sisters that have spiritual children, they're fulfilled. And of course there's a sacrifice there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Giving up the natural call, the original call. But the Lord blesses all of that, right? And he makes it, he's not outdone in generosity, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, even for, like, folks called to the single life, right? Like, the Lord provides opportunities to nurture spiritual children, and it's not lesser, right? It's full, right? And it is enough, because he's enough. So I just wanted to, clarify
that.
Just in case anyone.
It's the serpent's voice that accuses women and says that you're not fulfilled, you know, and it's the serpent's voice that accuses man and says, you know, if you did what man should do and take and, you know, and, and be powerful and demonstrate your power in, in greed and in grasping. That's the voice of Satan.
Yeah.
And it's not the voice of the Father. And the voice of the Father, I think, is curiously absent in this, you know, whole thing, you know? And yeah, so wow, so that's crazy. So,
that's a good segue into kind of Macbeth's spiral, I think.
Beautiful.
He you know, right, like once he does this one deed and then resolves not to repent, that is the moment where he, I think, really goes off. So he's kind of in turmoil.
He takes the life of the king, but then he's in turmoil.
He's in turmoil, but then he kills the two servants.
He does, but although right before that, he's almost saying to his wife, like almost like, he almost just doesn't care if he gets caught type of deal.
Because he feels guilty.
Yeah, feels guilty. He still has the knives with him. Yep. He doesn't want to like go do the next thing. So he kind of says, like, you go do that.
Yeah.
But you're right. Then he moves on and he takes the lives of the guards.
And I think that's when the flip really starts. And she is, she's realizing the implications of what of what this all means. And he is also, but in a different way. So I think she maybe has some remorse there a little bit, or maybe not fully remorse, but she recognizes the gravity for sure. And he is resolved now to do whatever it takes and kill whoever he needs to.
Yeah.
And that's when the spiral really starts, I think. Well, I mean, it's already started at this point, but this is where he's now, it feels like there's no going back,
no.
Right? He's not showing any signs.
He's slowly walking down the stairs in the movie, and he's saying, and you can just tell on his face that he's in it now.
He's gone.
He's presenting false face to these people, and he's lying in a really manipulative way.
Yeah.
That's just like, it's very scary actually.
Yeah. It's very, because it's not human, right? And that's why I think we instinctually can kind of see that. And yeah, and I think you said voice of the Father is kind of absent, and that's because he is clamoring with himself at every turn. And that blows up at the banquet, right? When he sees this vision of Banquo, who he's just, he's good friend, right?
Yeah.
That he just very, feels like very quickly wrote off and said, no, we need to kill him and his son so that he doesn't have a line.
Yep.
And he gets this vision of Banquo and it ends up just being a bird, right? And they, you know, write it off as, oh, he's been like this since he was a child.
Right.
And then, of course, we have another vision again from the witches and he asks for, you know, all sorts of prophecy and stuff to guarantee his throne. And he gets some pretty, what would seem at least as pretty, pretty, you know, secure prophecy, I guess, kind of thing for his status, which is, you know, no one woman born is going to kill you.
Yep.
So that's a big, nice thing. You won't fall until the woods literally move.
Yep.
Burn him to Dunsinane. I hope I said that right. Whoops. And what was the other one? There was
those are the two big ones. Is there a third one?
Two big ones. I think there was a third one. How embarrassing.
I definitely know those are the two big ones for sure. Is that you know, yeah, not until the trees move, which is like saying like not until pigs fly. Right. And then you know, no man born of woman shall kill you. So when I heard both those things, right? This is my first time listening to this, watching it. So two things popped to my mind immediately, which was no man born of woman shall kill you. And then, of course, at the very end, spoilers, as they're going into combat and he's, you know, confidently saying like, no man born of woman shall kill me. Don't you know the prophecy?
So it was like putting the papers.
Yeah. But Macduff says, who's a man who...
I was from my mother's womb, untimely ripped. Or Macduff was from his mother's womb, untimely ripped.
Yes. I love that he talks in the third person there. But but he's saying that essentially, you know, I don't know if you called it cesarean section back then, but but he was, you know, he was taken from his mother's womb. He wasn't born in the traditional way. And so suddenly Macbeth realizes his error. Because also previous to that... Oh. The trees had moved because what was it? Why did they do this?
They were trying to disguise the size of the army,
right?
And so they had all of the soldiers hew off a limb, I think.
Yes,
and they all kind of were holding tree branches basically over them to kind of do a I don't know, a quasi-camouflage, if you will. So kind and of so like when the army then moves, it looks like the forest is kind of shifting.
Yes.
Which was the prophecy that the forest would shift.
Yeah.
And so the herald or whatever, the little kiddo that communicates this to him, he's like, I am going to kill you if what you say is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, no, 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 dude. This is right. Wood straight up moved.
So what's crazy is that, okay, so I'd heard this story. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. I'd heard this story about him, but I didn't know what it was in reference to. Was that when Tolkien was a kid, he had heard the story of what I now realize is the story of Macbeth, where in which they say, you know, the trees are moving, you know. And he, as a kid, he was really frustrated to learn, no, the forest didn't actually get up and move. It's actually the people with the branches. And so therefore, that's what led him to write the Ents and the March of the Ents.
Where the forest literally...
Yeah, they're literally trees that get up and move. And it's not just a few trees, but like there's a part where there's the March of the Ents. I think it might be a whole chapter in the Two Towers, where like the whole forest moves and stops the retreat of the armies of Isengard. And so he was like getting back at that, you know, like you didn't give me that real story of trees moving. So he wanted to do that. So I was like, wow, he was inspired by this. But he also straight up stole that part too about the man not born of woman.
Yeah.
Because in The Return of the King,
right,
you have the Witch King of Angmar.
I am no man.
Yeah. You know, he basically says, you know, you fool, you know, do you not know the prophecy? you know, no living man shall kill me. And then Eowyn says, you know, I am no man. And, you know, she's not a man. She's a woman. And she pulls her helmet off because she'd been pretending and strikes him down. So I was like, whoa, this is crazy that my boy Tolkien was so inspired by Macbeth.
I mean, it makes sense. It was probably very entrenched in his childhood being in England and... Yeah, and being brought up in an oratory. Right, he was brought up in an oratory.
Yes, I believe so.
At least for a good part of his life. Yes, so it would make sense that he was surrounded by a lot of classical work. And yeah.
It was good. And it even made me appreciate more some elements of the movies, where in the movies there's a little bit more tension with, at least in my mind, more tension between Theoden and Aragorn and Denethor and Aragorn. Like that tension of like, steward and king and who will be king and all this is very much brought to the fore, and it's very there's a lot of tension and drama
power,
there
yeah.
that I think is not as explicit in the books, or at least there's a lot more going on in the books, so you don't feel as much like, ooh, Theoden feels, you know, aggressed by Aragorn being here. In the movies, that's very clear. A big dynamic. But I feel like that's fair that they brought that in, because it's a very Shakespearean thing, and clearly Macbeth and other works were influential on Tolkien, and so I think that makes sense. And of course, half the actors in The Lord of the Rings are Shakespeare actors, you know, Ian McKellen and John Noble and all of
big
them.
Big facts.
Anyhow, that's my little Lord of the Rings.
Stage actor. All right, hot take. Stage actors make the best screen actors.
Oh, absolutely. I said it. Oh, at least they make super fun ones, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Like if you want to have like
really
a good
interesting choices.
A good amount of them.
Like
they make great choices. And it's fun to see them not be Shakespearean, you know, like just be a different.
Which is an interesting thing for this adaptation is that.
Good point.
I think largely it was a pretty. What were the words you used? Really
the word I used naturalist? Was like a more naturalist approach to.
Denzel just sounds
lines.
Like Denzel. He's not. Yeah. I mean, he sounds Shakespearean in as much as he's saying words that Shakespeare wrote.
Which we didn't say. Well, to be clear, Denzel Washington plays Macbeth, which
is
really fun.
Yes.
Really fun.
Which is good. I think he does a good job.
I loved it. And again, as someone who's not super familiar with a ton of Shakespeare works, and certainly did not know this one, it was so easy for me to engage with it. Like I appreciate that it wasn't, super theatrical in the way that, or super traditional Shakespearean.
It's interesting you would say not super theatrical, because I find it very theatrical. It's taking it at a, you know, it's a take on it, right? It's not like a faithful, necessarily strictly.
Let me back that up.
Period piece.
The way that they speak is not
sure.
It does
sure.
not have a
because
theatricality
it's
to it.
Okay.
It's not like this doesn't look like they're just acting on a stage in the way that they're speaking.
Sure.
But I loved. Sure. You are totally correct, and I agree. Like I loved that the setting
drama.
Of it, the drama, the all of the sets
yeah.
were so, like, you felt you were, like, huge. On an expanded play.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it just felt like they did such a good job of not trying to make it.
It did feel like it could have been right? on a stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just realizing that. It totally felt like it could have been on a stage.
Like a modern stage where you can do clever things that make you feel like you're almost not on a stage.
Yeah.
You know, and in this case, it was almost more like they did clever things that made you feel like you were watching a stage play. I loved it. And to be clear too, it's black and white. Super it's in 4:3 aspect ratio. Whoa. Super, super cool. They definitely were trying to go for like the artsiness.
It worked.
And it worked. It was great.
Totally worked. You're okay. So we watched this together. Yeah. And your wife, Sarah, made such an interesting point about the textures coming through with the black and white and the different costumes. And I think just shout out to the costumers, the textures of the outfits, I think lent themselves so well to, I think just to, to the overall characters and where they were at was conveyed.
Yes.
Shout out to Banquo's eyebrows. We love to see them.
That was amazing. Well, also, actually, with that, too, I was realizing, I mentioned, I think, while we were watching it, I said, ooh, this is kind of reminding me of The Seventh Seal, which is an old movie. It's on one of the top movies ever made, directed by, I think, Ingmar Bergman is his name. But it's also black and white. I think it's also 4:3. It's definitely an old movie. And I think it's in Swedish, I want to say. But I was realizing, I was like, that totally felt like that. And I just Googled a quick image from the movie because I was like, I want to see if my memory is serving me correctly. Mm-hmm. And the scene in that one that everyone remembers the most, if you have seen Seventh Seal, which you probably haven't. But if you have seen it, there's a scene where Death plays chess with the knight figure. And Death is personified, and he's wearing these black robes, and he has this little black kind of skull cap. And I was realizing, oh crap, that the witch wears that exact same kind of knit black, close to her head, hood or hat, right?
Wow,
like, it looks exactly like that. And I was looking up Macbeth witches. That's not like the typical way to portray them. Mm-mm. It was definitely a callback to Death, the figure of Death in the Seventh Seal. So yeah, I had to get my arcane.
How's that for some freaking referencing?
Yeah, I got Easter
haven't
eggs,
referenced
Easter
signs
eggs.
In a little bit though, so we're
I'm
doing
sorry.
Pretty good.
We are doing great. I've been holding my tongue. just kidding. So no, there hasn't been.
Andy, it's okay. If you want to reference signs, you can reference signs.
Oh, it's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, let's start moving towards our last kind of notes here.
Totally.
So, gosh. Yeah, any other like main themes that you just feel like we got to cover this? This was
I think just a little thing is how we deal with suffering and evil, right? Whether that's evil that we have committed or evil others have committed. You see, so Macduff is an upright, you know, a good man, and Macbeth murders his entire family because he's threatened by him, and Macduff learns of this, and Malcolm, Duncan's son, the heir to the throne, says, you know, no, like, come on, use this rage and let's go kill him. Let's start, you know, use this vengeance. And Macduff says, I will war like a man, but first I must grieve like a man, or something to that effect. I don't quite I'm butchering that, but and so we see there that Malcolm is trying to use Macduff's grief and trying to kind of show him, like, here's how I've dealt with my father's passing. I'm going to kill this guy. And it's interesting that Macduff is the one that dispatches Macbeth and not Malcolm. And Macduff is the one that has taken his grief and has said, and it seems anyway, has made the deliberate choice that I'm going to kill this guy because he needs to die, not necessarily because I'm being vengeful. And so I don't think that's absolute right. Like, I'm sure there, you know, that's probably very blurry and very difficult as he's fighting Macbeth, right?
Right.
But it would seem anyway that Macduff, the righteous man, is the one that justly gets to kill Macbeth in the end. So I think when we're looking at evil in our own hearts, because it's there. Spoiler alert. And then when we're looking at evil done to us, we absolutely must take the side of mercy, with ourselves, right? And Macbeth doesn't, right? Mm. He's so resigned to his sin and his guilt that he actually sins more.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of being merciful and coming forward, he actually doubles down. And then we see on the flip side, Macduff, who has had this evil done to him, right? Macduff really hasn't done anything wrong, has this evil done to him and yields to where he's at and the mercy. And then it's from that righteousness and justice is able to come forward and Macbeth dies. And if Macduff hadn't yielded to that mercy, Macbeth would still be alive, because for all we know, Macduff's the only one that wasn't of woman born.
Yeah.
Macduff was literally the only one that could kill Macbeth.
Right.
So it was absolutely paramount that he be merciful on himself and allow himself to grieve, and then kind of, you know, set his mind and then go about what he needed to. So, yeah. So I think just my final thought there is when we're seeing ourselves as we are, and we're startled and we're taken aback, and when we're seeing others as they are and we're startled and taken aback, and maybe we forget about some of that stuff that we have done, when we see others, which is easy to do, easy work of the world, the flesh, the evil one, to make ourselves think that we're somehow, you know, removed from sin and evil, when we see all of that, let us choose mercy, and let us recognize, like you were saying earlier, that we have wounded the Father, and that he has not, you know, put up a shield in that process. He's kept his arms open the entire time, the entire time through us wounding him. And then they're still open and waiting to forgive us. And so I think we need to imitate that in a big way. And I think that that's something to pull away from a rather dark story.
Yeah. That's great. I love that. I want to end on that note. That is just beautiful.
Groovy.
That is beautiful. I'll just add one note on to that too. It's definitely, that really just strikes me. That's something I've been praying with recently is this idea of instead of in my life, just responding with action. When I sin, rather taking time to mourn and to bring it to the Lord and like let him heal me and move from there. I've definitely seen a lot of fruit from that is to, instead of just immediate response, rather like take it to him and work through things with the Father first. So that's what would be our encouragement as well. So gosh, well, this is great. I'm so glad we watched this. Yeah. This is amazing. So worth it. I feel so
worth spending
so
our movie night token on that. Yeah.
No, that's so true. Yeah, we did.
Andy and I used all of our, in the recruiting department, we had a little movie night with all of our coworkers, and Andy and I spent all of our chips convincing people to watch this movie.
Because the original.
Because they were like, we were going to watch Shark Tale. Which was shot down by
my wife.
Your wife.
Yeah, mi esposa.
And then and then we were like, hey, Macbeth, you know, we've got to do it for the podcast anyway. It'd be great. We could all watch it. And then people were like, at one point it was like, let's watch Titanic. Oh my gosh. I'm going to get so much crap for saying it like that.
They so gracefully allowed us to do it.
They were so generous.
They were so generous, so graceful.
Learn from
them. Yeah. And so it was wonderful to watch it with them. And I loved hearing them exclaim when the different things with the witch happened and all that sort of thing. Like, but it was such a wonderful time watching it. And I hope you guys get a chance to watch it.
Please do.
Please let us know your thoughts. Again, we are two simpletons. And there are so many people who much better know Shakespeare and that whole world. Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear your thoughts. But we hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Tune in next time when we, for real, discuss Through the Deep Dark Valley. By the Ohellos.
Though They Die is sponsored by Net Ministries. To get in touch with Andy and Ali, email us at thoughtheydie@netusa.org.
And to get involved as a net missionary, go to netusa.org/apply and apply today.
Do it.
Or tell a friend and send them the link. God bless. Bye.
Peace.